The fourth and final oral argument on today's calendar is case number A22-785, Acede LLC versus Derek Stutes and another. Counsel, I believe you both understand that you each will have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for rebuttal. You can choose either the center lectern or either of the side lecterns. The center lectern has the colored light system. Counsel for appellant, you may feel free to take your seat. And counsel for appellant, unless you wish to speak, counsel for appellant, you may approach and introduce yourself and your client and begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Rick Dole from the Godwin Dole Law Firm, here on behalf of Acede LLC, appellant in this matter. Ultimately, there's really one question before this court. Was Acede LLC required to bring its personal property claims against respondents in the real property suit referenced in our briefing in court file number 27 CV 17 9493? And that's ultimately based on two applicable doctrine, the first being res judicata, the second being ripeness. And for res judicata to apply, they had to have the same parties, which is undisputed, same or similar set of facts, or the same transaction. In this case, we are dealing with real property and personal property. Oftentimes in real estate transactions, what you will see is a contract for deed, a warranty deed, or a purchase agreement, and then also a bill of sale. Simply put, Your Honors, appellant's argument is that the personal property itself was not included in the sale of the real property. There is no bill of sale. There is no reference to the transfer of the real property anywhere in the record, other than the fact that there were pictures of the real property associated with the personal property related to the advertisement under which respondents ultimately purchased the real property via contract for deed.
Mr. Dole, before we go any further on res judicata issues, I want to ask about, you said there's one issue in the case. The district court had two parts to its order. It made two conclusions of law. The first had to do with res judicata. The second, alternatively, the heading says, alternatively, plaintiff failed to meet its burden on proving damages. And in your opening brief, you make no challenge to the district court's second basis for its order. So, I mean, even if we were to agree with you on res judicata, wouldn't we be obligated to affirm on the alternative ground, which is unchallenged on appeal?
You wouldn't, Your Honor, because if you
look, would or would not?
Would not. Sorry, I should be more clear. You would not, Your Honor, because you'll see in that order there's a specific qualification that alternatively, and to the extent the determination under res judicata does not dispose of the matter, alternatively, plaintiff has failed to meet his burden of damages. And ultimately, we think that decision was erroneous as it relates to the testimony provided by defendant.
Okay, well, so I see that clause that you're pointing out, to the extent that plaintiff's claims are not barred by res judicata, but that's sort of the premise of my question. If we were to agree with you on your sole argument that res judicata does not bar the claim, then what about the alternative ground?
The alternative ground, Your Honor, is, I believe, covered in our reply briefing, and I think we did reference it in our initial briefing, is that ultimately the evidence of damages was admitted by defendants at trial.
But, I mean, you're familiar with the general rule that an appellant must raise all of its arguments for reversal in the opening brief, right? Cannot save an argument for the reply brief.
Certainly, Your Honor. And if ultimately we did miss that entirely, and if the court believes it's not before it, and rules that res judicata is appropriate or wasn't decided appropriately by the trial court, and the court determines that that doctrine does apply, then appellant would be out of luck. But that also brings us to the issue of ripeness after res judicata. As we had discussed in our briefing, appellant had no way of knowing whether or not the personal property was going to be returned until after an adjudication of title to the real property. Only at that time where title to the real property was adjudicated did appellant learn that the personal property wasn't going to be returned. Appellant learned that when
I mean, he turned over possession of the unit, wasn't fully paid off. There was a contract for deed yet, but with the appliances there, correct? I mean, the appliances were in the condo when he turned over possession and gave the keys to the buyers.
They were, Your Honor.
Yeah. And so how was that suddenly a few years later and now give it back to me? I mean, it's like I just don't understand the logic. And I know I'm not being very legal in my arguments here. And I know the court, you know, talked about res judicata and the, you know, failure to prove up damages adequately. But it just makes no sense to me. I mean,
It's a practical question, Your Honor, and I'll give you a practical answer. As a practical matter, certain items of personal property were returned after the adjudication of ownership of the real property, and only after only certain things, like a chair and certain other smaller items, were returned, and respondent said, or appellant said, I would like to come and pick up the rest. I've cleared out this parking space, and you'll see that in the record. Did appellant become aware that the rest of the personal property wasn't going to be returned? It was only at that time that this issue was raised. And it was only at that time that this became ripe.
So what's the distinction between personal property and real property? I mean, light fixtures are part of the real property, but a dishwasher that's not a freestanding dishwasher isn't? I mean,
it's specific to the items noted in the record, Your Honor. It's appliances and certain other easily movable items. We'd certainly never argue that you'd want to rip a light fixture off. You'd want to rip cabinets out. That wouldn't make sense. Those are fixtures. They're attached to the real estate. Nothing that's included within the personal property that appellant was asking for would be considered attached to the real estate. It's all the plug-and-play items, similar to the items that were returned to appellant, a chair, a table, and some other small furnishings.
It is, I mean, it is, this is more goes to the merits, it may not be relevant, but it is counterintuitive. Most of us, I think, are accustomed to buying and selling homes where the appliances stay put.
You're right, Your Honor. And when you do that, I'm sure when each judge here bought their own home, you'll see that it's accompanied by a bill of sale for personal property. A bill of sale that specifically addresses what items are going with.
I was imagining that there might be a provision within the purchase agreement saying that it includes all appliances that are currently in place.
If it included such provision, Your Honor, then it would have included the transfer of those items of personal property. It didn't. And as a result of that, the items of personal property did not transfer. And that's where the ripeness doctrine ultimately does come into play, because only after that real property suit was adjudicated did appellant become aware of the fact that respondent wasn't going to return the rest of the items.
And I know that, I mean, factually, I think you're correct that this dispute over the appliances arose after the conclusion of the 2017 case. But it seems that didn't have to happen that way. I mean, your client could have, in the 2017 case, the respondents here were seeking an order, declaratory judgment that they, the contract for deed is not terminated, not canceled, and that the closing should go forward. Your client opposed that action, opposed that request. I mean, your client could have argued in the alternative, could have said to Judge Burke, in the alternative, even if the closing does go forward and the contract for deed is restored and fulfilled, the court should take care to make sure that personal property that's presently on the premises is not part of the, you know, district court's order. The district court should limit its order to the real property. Your client could have done that.
Could have.
But didn't.
Correct.
So it seems like the timing of this issue arising was of your client's choosing, it seems to me.
And ultimately, the question isn't could somebody have bring a claim, it's whether or not it's mandatory. Whether or not they truly, could someone bring that claim? Sure. But I don't think he truly could from a practical matter, because at that time, how could he have been aware that the personal property items that were not included in the contract for deed, not included in the purchase agreement, as Your Honor pointed out, how could he have been aware of the fact that they weren't going to be returned? I don't think he could have. So as a practical, purely hypothetical, could someone bring that claim if they're going to kitchen sink?
He could have become aware if he had raised it in the litigation. Then he would have gotten a response from opposing parties.
Well, at that point, then he would have raised it in the litigation, and it's very likely we wouldn't be here, Your Honor. And so I see what Your Honor is saying. I just think that from a purely practical matter, based upon the record before it, the issue associated with the personal property only became an issue upon appellant's learning that respondent was only going to return that discrete set of items and not the rest of the personal property. And highlighting what the real property suit was, Your Honor, that was a notice of cancellation sent from appellant to respondent. Respondent filing an action regarding specific to that notice of cancellation. Provides for a very specific statutory scheme that contracts for deed can be canceled, not canceled under, under Minnesota statute section 559.202 through 21, in large part section 21 of that statute. Nowhere in that statute will you see any reference to personal property or ancillary contracts to a contract for deed. It is hyper-specific. And looking at the findings and order of the real property suit decision, there is no discussion of anything ancillary to solely other than title to that real property, interpreting the contract for deed. And nothing in the contract for deed references any stitch of personal property to be transferred or not transferred between the parties.
Does the concept of compulsory counterclaim come into play here?
Citing to Minnesota Rules of Procedure 1301. I believe.
I'm just wondering if that's relevant. I mean, in other words, does the law about, you know, on the first requirement for res judicata, same cause of action, same set of factual circumstances, is that interrelated with the law concerning compulsory counterclaims?
Absolutely it is, Your Honor. Because ultimately, if you look at the language of 1301, it mimics in large part the case law cited by both appellants and respondents. And so to that end, I think a lot of that case law extended out from that rule specifically. And whether or not appellant was mandated at that time to file the counterclaim related to the personal property. And I think if you look to that rule itself and the case law that both parties have cited, it simply falls outside of the transaction related to the real estate because of the lack of reference in any of the documents associated with it. And the practical matter, as Your Honors have stated, that you've never really seen a real estate transaction occur where certain items of personal property weren't transferred. At no point has you taken everything in a home unless you specifically contract for it, correct? And so thinking of that in the hypothetical or the reverse, had respondent lost title to the property in that real property suit, would they have then been able to simply take all the personal property out and go because there's no reference to it? In the purchase agreement, there's no reference in the contract for deed, but there's been an adjudication of that issue. And holding consistent with what the trial court has in this case would functionally allow respondent to do exactly that. Because appellant didn't bring it in that real property suit, even if they would have won, respondent would be entitled to take everything and walk away. So with that, appellant will rest, Your Honors, unless there are further questions.
It appears not. Thank you, Mr. Dole. Counsel for respondent, you may introduce yourself and your client and begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Karen Kurth. I represent the respondents, Derek Stutz and Tia Resbeck, in this case. May it please the court, counsel. Res judicata is, you know, based on the premise that we should have some finality in the world of litigation. It's designed to put in to hopefully to stop bad faith, vexatious litigation that goes on and on and on and on. I'm going to represent to this court if I've ever seen a case that's in badly in need of the application of res judicata, it's this one. This is the sixth court that some form of this case has been in front. Three conciliation court, two district court, and now the appellate court. And it's been going on for about 5.5 years. The basis of the respondents, or I'm sorry, the appellant's res judicata argument has generally been this idea that the claims are different, right? The claims in the action that the appellant brought for conversion, civil theft, quantum of merit are different than the claims. And they've characterized the 2000 litigation very narrowly, and I need to correct that. That litigation wasn't just about the cancellation of the contract for deed. It was way broader about than that because the respondents, who were the plaintiffs in that case, specifically asked the court to declare the payoff on a contract for deed. If that case had just, Your Honor, it's just been about the idea of was there a default? Is cancellation proper? Was there a default? Was it cured? Simple questions, right? We wouldn't have spent a year and a half litigating that. It went way beyond that. The issues in that case were that there was a default. There was no question about that. My clients, the respondents, didn't make the balloon payment. They got 60 days during that cancellation period to cure the default. That's the whole point of that statutory scheme. They couldn't cure the default because a seed wouldn't give them the payoff amount that was consistent with the terms of the contract for deed. So while, yes, we asked to enjoin the cancellation of the contract for deed, of course we did, but the whole case was about the payoff. The whole case was about the payoff. And that operative facts that determines whether res judicata involves the same claims. It's not just how we label a claim. The case law tells us in res judicata, the claim is about the operative facts involved. It's not about the label that we put, how we name the claim, whether it's a conversion claim or a civil theft claim. So as an example, we spent 2 days in that case litigating all kinds of issues related to the payoff. The plaintiffs, then respondents now, put in evidence about why the payments they had made on the contract for deed should reduce the payout. The defendant in that case put in evidence about why it shouldn't reduce the principal. And as a kind of a good example of how broad the courts required, and this was Judge Susan Burke in that case, how broad the courts required analysis became. It was announcing that contract for deed. What did it say? What didn't it say? How do we interpret it? Is there an ambiguity? Is there a vagueness? What's included?
But
what
isn't?
But your
client, gave back certain items of personal property, so I can see, there was some kind of understanding about this and why you wouldn't litigate an issue that you didn't even know might be opposed. I think that's appellant's position and they did deliver, so why not all of it? And until they didn't get all of it, there wasn't a conversion claim.
I'm going to disagree with the appellant's argument there and say that that's not what res judicata is about. It's not. It's whether they could have brought the claim, whether they could have brought that claim. And I'm submitting to in their brief and to a lesser degree in their argument, there's all kinds of statements about how limited.
But there are some claims that are mandatory.
Yes.
And others that aren't.
Yes.
So you're saying this would be a mandatory counterclaim when the appellant didn't even know that there was an issue over this or that it was being contested?
First, I'm going to take issue with the idea that the appellant didn't have any reason to believe that this would come up. There was testimony in the, and I know that first cause of action isn't what's being appealed here. I understand that. So if you'll bear with me, I hope I can connect up why I'm making this argument. There was actually some testimony about the bar stools and the hanging chair and the table, that other personal property. That actually did come up in the first litigation. It didn't come up in the context of whether they were going to return it because gosh, it never occurred to them not to return it. It came up in the context to, as to how the relationship between these parties kind of came south, went south. So when we're fighting about, when the whole point of the case is the payoff, and you kind of asked this question earlier, how does the appellant or the defendant in that case not say, well, gosh, the payoff needs to be increased by $6,500 for the value of the appliances, or they need to give them back? How does that not come up? That's the issue. They could have brought it, they should have brought it, and they didn't. There was no limitation on the evidence that was coming in that case. It's not as though the evidence was curtailed to just deal with default. We're litigating the payoff. That was the whole point of that case.
The payoff amount would have been the amount due solely on the contract for deed, right? Mr. Dold has taken the position that the personal property was not part of the contract for deed. It was a separate agreement, apparently an oral agreement. Mm-hmm. And so even still, do those issues about the return of appliances amount due for personal property, is that still necessarily factor into either the payoff amount or the first lawsuit?
Good question. If we're looking strictly and saying that, well, the contract for deed was in evidence and Mr. Dold's position was the contract deed didn't mention the appliances, and this was a terrible contract for deed. I don't know what else to say. And it just was. There should have been a purchase agreement attached to it. There should have been some reference to the appliances to it. No doubt about it. But to say that the parties were limited then to litigating only to the issues that were strictly in the contract for deed, that's not, I don't believe that's true. I mean, an example is there was no interest rate in the contract for deed. I agree, that's highly unusual. The defendant's position, they put on an expert witness because their position was an interest rate wasn't in the contract for deed, but because that's normal for a contract for deed, we should imply an interest rate. Judge Burke didn't agree with that.
I think Judge Johnson's question was specific to the payoff or the payout. Presumably, there's a bit of a more obvious connection between an interest payment, whether there should be when you're trying to determine the payout, than the connection between personal property. So are you conceding that the dispute about the declaration that was requested in the earlier litigation did not include any discussion of personal property? That's outside of the requested declaration.
I'm not 100% sure. I mean, in terms of did our request for relief request that request the court rule about the appliances? Is that the question?
Right. Or no. Is that separate? Because if it sounded like you were going to concede in answer to Judge Johnson's question that was not part of the payout.
It wasn't. But my position is, how could it, in reviewing how res judicata applies and what we look at, whether there's these same operative facts support the litigation, how could that claim not have been part of a question on the payoff? I guess that's my position. They could have brought it. The contract for deed was already being in evidence and being heavily litigated, and they didn't. And then there's this whole idea of they didn't know the plaintiffs or the respondents in this case were not going to return the personal property. That's interesting. But Judge Burke did not make findings on those. That is true. But I think the issue is, could they have brought that claim? They could have, and I think they should have brought the claim. And it gets barred by res judicata. We wouldn't be here. Mr. Dold is absolutely correct. We wouldn't be facing conversion and civil theft claims had we litigated the issue of the appliances, either as mitigating the payoff or a direct decision by the court that they weren't entitled to a decrease in the payoff or an increase in the payoff, excuse me, but to account for the appliances. So, but now it turns into a conversion claim because, of course, my clients refused to return the appliances. I want to address, if there are no further questions on the res judicata issue, I'd like to address quickly this damages issue because I'm not 100% sure I quite understand what the appellant is asking for on the damages issue. I believe that Judge Robner made an alternative determination. If res judicata doesn't do away with this, she made a finding that they had failed to meet their burden of proof on the damages. Their position in their brief has been, well, the judge was required to take evidence, rebuttal evidence put in by my client that the appliances were worth $2,400 or something like that. I think we have to address the standard of review. They're challenging a finding here. They're challenging the judge's finding that there's insufficient proof of damages put in at trial, and that the amount of those damages was not proven up. The standard of review is clearly erroneous. There is ample information, and the record is full of evidence why Judge Robner made that determination. Because there was really no evidence put in. So she doesn't, Judge Robner isn't required to consider that other rebuttal evidence. She can just rule the standard of review is clearly erroneous. It has to be manifestly contrary to the weight of the evidence that was put in. Reviewing her order and the trial testimony, it cannot be said that her finding that they failed to prove damages is manifestly contrary to that.
Didn't the district court's opinion say the only evidence in support of damages was it Brenner or Brennan?
Yes.
And the word only there seems to be manifestly contrary to the record then.
Does the order say only? That was, I guess, if she says that, that's...
Solely? I can't remember if it's only or solely, but I can look it up later.
Yeah, that's all right, Your Honor. I think the context of that is that's the only evidence that the plaintiff who has the burden of proof put into evidence to support their claims. I don't think she was intending to say that there wasn't some rebuttal testimony by my client that they looked up the appliance value online. I think it was the idea, Your Honor, that there's no documentary evidence, nothing like that was submitted. So, and again, it's standard of review is clearly erroneous, and it's not this court's job to find something in the record that supports evidence of damages. The question is there evidence in the record that supports Judge Robner's conclusion that they failed to meet their burden of proof on damages? So I see my yellow light is on. So what the damages, proof of damages in the record were, we don't even have proof that who owned those appliances, who bought them, what's the measure of damages for a conversion claim. Or, we don't have, none of that is in the record based on the testimony, nor based on the rebuttal testimony. What is the measure of damages here? The testimony of Mr. Brenner seemed to indicate the measure of damages is today's replacement value. My client's rebuttal testimony was, well, maybe the depreciated value of those appliances today. And I say I'm out of time, so I'm going to conclude. And respectfully ask this court to affirm the decision of the district court in full. And thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Ms. Kurth. Mr. Dole, do you have an opportunity for rebuttal?
Very briefly.
I just want to highlight one statement respondent made in its argument today, and that is it never occurred to respondent not to return certain items of property. And if it never occurred to respondent not to return certain items of property, how could it have occurred, or how could appellant have come aware of the fact that it wasn't going to receive that property upon return? Thank you, Your Honors.
If I can follow up on the damages argument as well, I just want to make sure I understand. I didn't see in the brief you disputing the district court's summary of Brenner's testimony.
Certainly, Your Honor.
So you're not alleging that there's a clear error in the way that the district court looked at Brenner's testimony. You're conceding that Brenner didn't have receipts and was giving an estimate based on his experience, but there wasn't any additional evidence or documents that he could point to. You concede that that is correct, the way the district court reviewed that.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. The case is deemed submitted, and the court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days. That is our last oral argument on today's calendar, so the court is now adjourned.
Have a wonderful afternoon, Your Honor.